No, I didn't sound sufficient.
And please report, Mr. Kevin Keith, this is an argument for system.
May it please the court, as correctly identified, my name is Kevin Keith. I practice with the firm Bailey Williams, Westfall Lee and Fowler. My appearance this morning is on behalf of petitioner Aetna Life and Casualty Company, appellee below and defendant in the district court. The respondent and plaintiff in the district court is Raymond Gunn individually and his next friend of Christopher Gunn, the named beneficiary under the two insurance policies in issue. The employee whose eligibility under the group insurance policies is in question is Phyllis Diane Gunn. For clarity, I will refer to the parties as Aetna and respondent Gunn. References to...
I can just make it Gunn.
Well, very well. References to Mrs. Gunn will be by her proper name. This is a case of contract construction involving an eligibility formula that determines group insurance coverage. The sole issue presented by the summary judgment record is the meaning of the phrase continuous service or the word service as used in this employment context. Aetna's policy did not define that language. It is Aetna's position that in this employment context and by ordinary custom and usage, the word service or continuous service commences on the date that an employee reports to work and begins performing labor to the benefit of the employer for which the employee receives compensation. The case was submitted to the district court on stipulated facts, and summary judgment was granted in favor of Aetna. Respondent Gunn urges, and the Dallas Court of Civil Appeals held, that the eligibility requirement is ambiguous and can be reasonably read to mean that continuous service commences on the date two parties agree to enter into an employment relationship, even though the date that actual service will be performed for which compensation will be received will be at some future date. I was unable to locate a Texas case dealing with this specific question and believe it to be one of first impression in this state. I further believe that the determination of this question will have a far-reaching effect because the stated years of service or continuous service or the phrase uninterrupted service is commonly used as a guideline to compute employee benefits for pension plans, retirement, job status, or in this case, group insurance coverage. And those contracts are currently in existence. I ask the court first to consider the entire contract, all of the language used by the parties to create this contractual relationship. First, the Aetna insurance application card is in evidence and is attached as an appendix to petitioner's application for writ of error. This insurance application card is provided through Fisher Scientific Company, or Phyllis Gunn's employer, to supply to all of its employees who wish to apply for the group insurance benefit. On that card, there is a space provided for an employment date. That date was filled in with the date of September 7, 1976, the first day that she reported for work. The insurance card was signed on September 3, 1976, by Phyllis Gunn, contemporaneous with her executing the employment contract. Of greater significance, that I believe provides even more insight into the intentions of the parties, and in particular Phyllis Gunn, are three blank spaces on the insurance card. for the employee to designate the anticipated effective date of insurance coverage for life insurance, accidental death and dismemberment, and temporary disability benefits. On Phyllis Gunn's insurance card, those spaces were filled in with the date of December 7th, 1976. Thus, Phyllis
now,
Gunn...
Just how does that read? Did it say effective date and then a date?
Your Honor, I believe that is correct. To the left are listed the individual policy coverages of life insurance, accidental death, and above it are the effective dates, and then a line provided next to each coverage for the designation of that date.
Is it contended that Ms. Gunn filled those dates in herself, or was that done by somebody else, or is there any evidence?
It is not disputed, and she did sign the card and dated it September 3rd.
Well, the question was, who filled in the date? Any question about, did she fill it in, or did the company employee, or does anybody know?
That was not among the stipulated facts in the summary judgment record, and I would be going outside the record to comment on it.
Counsel, those are very persuasive arguments on your behalf, the dates for effective, but I understand this is summary judgment, and you're contending that these facts make a summary judgment case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose, for example, the lady had gone to whoever it was, had gone to Europe. The question may not be when these things become effective, but when she became employed, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And so she signed this card and then took a three-week vacation, during which she happened on some scientific discovery. And your contract requires her to share that with you or him, whoever it was. Now, that's our problem, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, she was found by your contract during this. It's just a few days here, but it could have been a month. He said, well, or 6 months.
I don't think that the designation by her of the anticipated effective date is absolutely determinative.
Yes, and this is summary judgment. It's got to be absolutely determinative. Something is.
I think because that is undisputed, those designated anticipated effective dates, taken cumulatively with all of the other summary judgments, evidence. I believe that Aetna is entitled as a matter of law to summary judgment. These anticipated effective dates are just one more indication of the intention of Phyllis Gunn and Aetna as to when her continuous service would commence and when the effective dates would arrive.
I show stipulated facts. Was that filed with the trial court in connection with the summary judgment?
Yes, Your Honor. And it is in the transcript, I believe pages 13 through 149.
Well, now, did I understand the stipulation of both parties that really the question for us to determine is whether the term, quote, continuous service, unquote, is ambiguous? That is the key to this case.
That is true.
And actually what this insurance card says does not really have any direct bearing on whether or not the term continued service is ambiguous, does it?
I think it
gives some background, but it's look at this, is this term ambiguous? Effective date on this card is ancillary to most of that.
I think the fact that the insurance coverage would become effective exactly 3 months after continuous service was initiated or commenced, taken together with these anticipated effective dates of December 7th being exactly 3 months after the date contended by Aetna, I believe is...
3 months or 3 days?
I'm sorry, 3 months. Mm-hmm. After the date that she first reported to for work, indicates an intention by the parties that continuous service should was expected to commence the first day she reported for work.
Well, don't you have a little problem there, though? If continuous service is not ambiguous, then we shouldn't even look to this, because it's not ambiguous, and you don't have to look anywhere. If it is ambiguous, you have to look to this extraneous matter. But if it is ambiguous, you also have the rule that that policy is going to be construed against the insured.
I understand your point. I think it's well taken. The position that we are asserting is that you are and should look at this language, because this insurance card should be read in conjunction with the insurance policy itself. And in construing the intent and whether of the insurance policy and whether or not the words continuous service as used in the insurance policy are ambiguous or not, you have to look at all of the language of the contract, which includes these anticipated effective dates.
Well, what we are really determining is whether or not the trial court had undisputed proof before it at the time of the summary judgment hearing, which would support a summary judgment. Now, the court had before it, I take it, this document which said the insurance would be effective on a certain date. Did the trial court have that before it?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't notice that either counsel cites the case of Life Insurance Company of the Southwest versus Overstreet, 603 Second 780. That case turns on the word effective date. Both of you may want to file some supplements to comment about that case, 1980 case.
Did I examine that case and provide a supplemental brief if allowed to, and if necessary? One further point that I wanted to note to the trial court, or to this court, is that also on the insurance card, there was a place provided for Phyllis Gunn to designate and exercise her option for immediate effectiveness of medical coverage. In that provision, she stated that she wanted those benefits to become immediately effective, not on the date that she signed the contract or on the date that she filled out the card, but on September 7th, her designated employment date. And we contend that that is the date that her 3-month continuous service requirement should be commenced. Computing Phyllis Gunn's 3-month continuous service from her stated employment date and actual date of compensated labor, or using the expressed anticipated date of life insurance coverage, results in the same effective date of December 7, 1976. Having deceased prior to that date, coverage was not obtained. Additional meaning of the eligibility provision in question, I believe, can be gathered from looking at other areas of the insurance policy. The eligibility provision is contained in Article 1, Section 3 of that provision, and it states that she will be entitled to coverage after 3 months of continuous service. Later in Article 1, Section 3, continuous service is limited by the policy stating how continuous service, or the running of continuous service, can be interrupted. Article 1, Section 3 in that respect states, any employee who is both disabled, ill, or injured, and away from work on the date employee coverage is to become effective, shall not be insured until he actually returns to work on a full-time basis. I believe this is consistent with the position that Aetna has taken, that continuous service in this context begins the first day that the employee reports for work and continues on. If it is interrupted by illness that keeps the employee from reporting to work and receiving compensation for labor doing for the employer, then that gives us additional evidence of the intention of the parties in using the word service or continuous service.
Captain, don't have a copy of that policy before. I know it's in the transcript, but now, is that limited to unable to report to work and not being paid? Is that in the policy? Would you read just the...
Yes, the quote again is, any employee who is both disabled, i.e. ill or injured, and away from work on the date employee coverage is to become effective, shall not be insured until he actually returns to work on a full-time basis.
So payment is not a part of that condition?
No, not unless it's implied. Phyllis Gunn wasn't paid on an hourly basis. She was not a salaried employee and would not be paid for time if she was not at work.
And now this policy covers your top engineers and scientists as well as the lowest employee on the ground. It applies to everybody. Right?
Yes, sir. Right.
That would be some salaried employees who might very well be paid during that period when they were sick, just before the policy came into effect. They'd still be on the payroll even though they were all sick.
Yeah. Okay. Thus, I do not believe that continuous service can be reasonably interpreted to be synonymous with the creation of an employment relationship, because the running of that continuous service by the express language of the policy can be interrupted by an event that does not in itself terminate the employment relationship. Aside from the intentions expressed on Phyllis Gunn's insurance card in the language of the insurance contract, Aetna asserts an additional and separate ground that the word service has a common meaning and usage connoting the actual performance of labor by an employee for which the employee receives compensation. Although dictionary definitions are not determinative, I think in this case they are somewhat instructive. This court in Van Zandt versus Fort Worth Press, cited in Petitioner's application for writ of error, adopted Webster's third new international dictionary definition of service to determine if personal service had been rendered under the attorney fee statute 2226. The definition there for service was action or use that furthers some end or purpose, conduct or performance that assists or benefits someone or something, deeds useful or instrumental towards some object. The Van Zandt opinion also quotes language of the Utah Supreme Court that the term services by ordinary usage and meaning has a broad and general meaning of performance of labor for the benefit of another. Similarly, the Wyoming Supreme Court has held that the ordinary meaning of the phrase continuous service causes it to commence on the first day of actual labor. That case is Arizona versus City of Sheridan, also cited in petitioner's application. Additional indication of the meaning of the word service and its ordinary usage can be gleaned from Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition, 1968, that defines service when it is used in an employment context as the act of serving the labor performed. The insurance card and insurance contract and ordinary usage.
Yeah, well, that's all again is very persuasive unless the employee agrees to not work until a certain date, not work for anybody else, or to give all patents during this period of time to your employer. So this working isn't necessarily controlling, is it?
I believe that in the employment context, when the word service is used, it connotes an active performance of labor. I think Your Honor is referring to the recitals of consideration in the employment contract between Fisher Scientific and Phyllis Gunn. My position on that is that those recitals of consideration and the mutual exchange of promises reflected in that contract do not constitute service under that contract.
Well, even the word service itself, got a problem. We're talking about people making public service as if they were making a sacrifice. Not in the sense they are, but they're also being paid.
That's why we have to look at the specific factual context in which this phrase is used. Black's Law gives several definitions for the word service, but specifies that in the employment contract context, service has the meaning of labor performed, the act of performing labor. I'd also say that the recital for consideration, although necessary for the formation of a binding bilateral contract, should not constitute service under that contract, taking the position that it might if you extend the fact in either direction, either if she signed the contract 4 months prior to her first day of labor instead of 4 days, it would have to be the respondent's position that she had qualified for these employee benefits before ever reporting for work, before ever being compensated, and before ever doing any labor. On the other hand, the recital also applies to a time subsequent to her employment status with Fisher Scientific Company. I think there it further shows that defining continuous service by reason of the recital is unreasonable, because there it would state that if she had been hired and fired within 2 days, 3 months later, although she's still bound by these contract recitals, I don't think it would be a fair interpretation of the contract language to say that she's qualified under the group insurance policies by having served her employer for 3 months. In summation, it is our position that Gunn's position that service commences on the date one party agrees to work for another is not a reasonable interpretation, and therefore should not be injected in this contract to create an ambiguity. Petitioner prays that the Court of Appeals decision be reversed and that summary judgment rendered by the trial court in favor of Aetna be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. The argument from the respondent.
As we of course, Stephen Porter will submit argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I am Steve Porter. I'm here for the respondent, Raymond Gunn. Raymond Gunn is the grandfather of Christopher Gunn, who is the beneficiary under his mother's policy, the two policies of insurance which are before the court this morning. Phyllis Gunn being the employee of Fisher Scientific, pursuant to the employment agreement and the document that we had before. My first comment would be to point out that this contract of insurance was prepared by Aetna. Aetna, in drafting the contract, certainly could have defined the term continuous service, but has very easily included language within the contract of insurance which would have stated when continuous service commences. And Aetna did not do that. Aetna has so stipulated that there is no definition of the term continuous service anywhere in its contract, anywhere in the brochures or other explanatory materials that may have been issued by Aetna for the various companies which were subscribers to this particular policy or policies.
Counsel, how do you handle the phrase effective date, September the 7th?
First of all, I think the phrase effective date is misleading. I think that the effective date of the coverage, as stated on that card, is erroneous. It was the policy says that service, that the effective date is when 3 months of continuous service have been completed, not at an arbitrary specific date which may have, which was filled in after the fact by an employee of Fisher Scientific, in other words, someone in their personnel department. The trial court had before it the deposition of the woman who actually put in those dates. And she put in the date, she was in Houston, never met Phyllis Gunn, filled in those dates the following week when the card was sent down to her office by Fisher Scientific personnel office in Dallas to the Houston office.
Tell me again who filled it in.
An employee of Fisher Scientific named Dolores Evans.
There's another place on that card that hurt Ms. Gunn. It says employment date, 9/7/76. Is there any allegation that that was made through mistake? Or
well, Your Honor, we don't know. We don't know if someone...
It's an allegation or not, I guess.
Well, what we don't know is what the intent, who, if she was directed to fill that date into that card, if she was told by the...
Understand, it could be done through mistake or you not knowing it, but what I was asking about is that issue raised. Stipulated fact, I hadn't seen the pleading, but is the issue of a mistake raised?
No, Your Honor. No, it's not.
Now, the 6th was a Sunday and the 7th was a Monday.
That's correct. No, the 6th was a Monday. I'm talking about September of 76. Mm-hmm. The 6th was Labor Day. The 7th, which was a Monday, the 7th was a Tuesday. That was the first day that she was paid.
A working day.
Yes.
Service day.
No, I think the service date was the date that she signed the employment agreement. And when you look at the stipulation, you know, and these are stipulations that were entered into between the parties. On September 2nd, she came in for her final interview and was accepted for employment. This was on a Thursday, September the 2nd, 1976. She was accepted on that date. She reported back on September the 3rd. Now, we don't, once again, we don't know what her intent was when she walked through the door of Fisher Scientific on September the 3rd. She may have been there to go to work. She may have been expected to report to her supervisor and be paid for that day. But instead, it appears that she did several things that day. She did fill out her W-4. She signed the employment agreement, which made certain obligations effective immediately as to non-competition, any patents, inventions that she might invent that day forward. In addition, she filled out the insurance card on that date. She signed as an employee. And she was directed by her employer to go to a doctor to take a physical. She was sent, as the stipulation said, was sent. We don't know that she needed a physical. This was something that was done for the benefit of her employer. I think at that point she was in the service of her employer. They wanted her to take
the physical. She had not passed the physical examination.
If she had not passed the physical examination.
And they determined, well, she's not physically able to perform this work. Would she be an employee while she was out there in the doctor's office?
Well, we don't know because we don't really know the sequence of events. It's very possible that she could have been by an interpretation. You could have said that if she had already filled out everything else and had been accepted and had signed an employment agreement, that she may have been an employee. They may have had to terminate her officially. There would be a difference there between whether or not she had become an employee and then been terminated or had never become an employee at all. But we don't know what order she did these things on September the 3rd. All we know is that she filled out certain documents, some obviously at the direction of her employer. She took the physical and I assume was prepared to go to work whenever, to go on the payroll to receive compensation at the direction of Fisher Scientific at that point in time. Now, coming back to this insurance card and the effective date, it is, you know, it is our contention that if a date was filled in by Phyllis Gunn, and I'm not a handwriting expert, but there is on that card what appears to be her handwriting with a date of employment is 9/7/76. There is a, in the miscellaneous provisions of the insurance policy, both policies, it says that neither clerical error in keeping records pertaining to the insurance or delays in making entries thereon shall invalidate insurance otherwise validly enforced or continue insurance otherwise validly terminated, but upon discovery of such error, an equitable adjustment of premium shall be made. If any relevant facts pertaining to an individual to whom the insurance relates shall be found to have been misstated, and if such misstatement affects the existence or the amount of insurance, the true facts shall be used in determining whether insurance is enforced under the terms of this policy and in what amount. Now that's language from Aetna's policy. So I would submit that if there was an error made in either calculating the effective date or an error made in what date she was directed to put on this insurance card, we still have to look to the true facts.
Did you plead mistake?
No, we didn't plead mistake, Your Honor. We pleaded that, we pleaded that service did commence on September 3rd, 1976, that that was the true date when service commenced for purposes of these policies, for determining the effective date of when that insurance coverage would come into effect. Now, it's also, you know, it's stipulated, and once again, the real issue before the court is, since there is no, the real issue is, when you look at the face of the policy, there is no definition of service, or continuous service, or when it commences. Aetna could have put that in there. They could have put a one-sentence definition of the service shall commence upon the date of hire, upon the date that an employment contract is signed, on the date that paid compensation begins, any number of ways. They could have defined it to suit themselves to alleviate this problem, but they have not done so. And they have stipulated that if service commenced on September 3rd, then they're obligated to pay these insurance proceeds. On the other hand, if service did not commence until September 7th, then we're not obligated, or we're not entitled to those same proceeds. But you have, I feel, two reasonable interpretations of when service commenced. The Court of Civil Appeals unanimously found that this contract is ambiguous, that there is no definition of service, that it does not appear from the terms of the contract itself, and that our interpretation, whether it be the more reasonable, is really not the point, according to this court's holdings in the past in construing insurance policies.
Well, in that connection, are you familiar with the opinion of life insurance in Southwest against Over Street?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
It surprised me that neither of you are, because we split 5-4 on the case versus, and there's some similarity to this. And, could you all prepare, would you care to prepare post-submission arguments?
Yes, Your Honor.
Say a week, both of you? Okay.
That would be fine. But once again, looking at this particular language, our interpretation does not have to be more reasonable than Edmund's interpretation. Our interpretation only has to not be unreasonable, I believe is maybe the correct way of saying that. As long as our interpretation is not in itself unreasonable, then we're entitled to the proceeds as being insured under this policy of insurance. So you know, it's clearly a question of the two interpretations, the fact that it is an ambiguous contract, that the term is not defined, and that we're asking that our interpretation be accepted, not because it's more reasonable, but because it's not unreasonable. I would also distinguish the other cases that were cited by the petitioner in his brief. I think I distinguished those in my brief, but I feel that neither of these out-of-state cases have direct application to the cases before this court. One of those cases involved really a question of status, when an employee went from a probationary employee to a regular employee. And the question before that court was not when did his service actually commence. That would have been the Arizona versus Sheridan case. The Zimmerman versus Board of Education case, the one out of New Jersey, involved a situation where the teacher in that case didn't go to work for a period of 60 days from the date that she was hired. However, she had no responsibilities, no duties, and was performing no functions for her employer. The employment contract that Phyllis Gunn signed imposed some duties on her, whether or not she ever performed these work tasks. She could have been given a layoff. Anything could have happened after that time as far as whether or not she was being paid. She could have been given been laid off or temporarily taken from the payroll, and yet she would have still, as long as she was an employee of Fisher Scientific, she had certain obligations with regard to non-competition, with regard to patents, any inventions that she might have had. But she had some duties. It wasn't like she was under no obligation to Fisher as an employee. Her obligations began on September 3rd and would have continued. For these reasons, we feel that the Court of Civil Appeals correctly reversed the judgment of the trial court. And we ask this court to affirm the ruling by the Court of Civil Appeals and to order that the insurance proceeds be paid pursuant to the terms of the policy. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal argument from petitioner.
A few closing comments. I believe that this court's decision in Glover First National Insurance Underwriters cited in application sets the proper rule of construction that the plain language of an insurance policy, like that of any other contract, will be given effect when the party's intent can be discerned, and that the intent will be discerned by looking at the entire factual contract, context, and the contract in which the language appears. It is true that Aetna did not define the word service in the insurance policy. They did define many terms that they felt or that the regulatory body felt needed to be defined. I believe that if you have to begin defining ordinary terms such as service, you will have to have additional definitions defining those terms that you use to define the word service. I would ask this court to apply the ordinary definition of service that it used in the case of Van Zandt that we discussed earlier. That being, service has an ordinary meaning of performance of labor for the benefit of another. When you read the insurance contract using that ordinary definition of the word service, it is not ambiguous. If this court finds that the term service is ambiguous, then it is ambiguous in every contract and statute that uses that term service where it is not otherwise defined. If continuous service is commenced by the mere agreement to do labor sometime in the future, and non-working persons are able to qualify for employee benefits, I believe a great injustice is done to their working counterparts who are, in most instances, competing for the same benefits and job status as the non-working person.
Counselor, is there any dispute about what Mr. Porter said, the lady in Houston working for the company X filled in those effective dates on the insurance card?
Your Honor, the deposition was not brought up on appeal, and in that instance, it is construed against the party who wishes to assert something from the contents of it.
I don't believe the answer to the question. Is it disputed? The contents of that deposition?
I have not read the deposition, Your Honor, because it was not brought up on appeal, and we did not take over this case until after the Court of Appeals judgment. And since it was not brought up, it was not part of the record to be considered.
Case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments for both parties. The court will receive a post-submission argument posted by you within a week. All right? Be excused from complicated.